Welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. I'm your host, Michelle Brown. Each week, we'll be talking with people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality, and creating change. Today, we're joined by Y. Falami DeVoe, holistic health practitioner and founder of Holistic Alchemy in Atlanta, Georgia. 3 years after Falami earned her master's in educational leadership from Antioch University Midwest, she suffered two mini strokes. She started on a self-care journey as a result of her health issues that continued and expanded. She had been juggling school, work, and family, and was beginning to understand the importance of balance and prioritizing herself. Falami is a body liberation and self-care coach, specializing in the self-care of women of color. She operates her business, Holistic Alchemy, from her hometown of Atlanta. Her work with clients involves individual sessions and group conversations. It incorporates her years of research in body positivity. She specializes in the healing and self-care of women of color, offering personal sound healing therapy sessions, body positive coaching, and workshops for women, holistic lifestyle coaching, and sound baths. This year, she'll earn her PhD from Antioch's Graduate School of Leadership and Change with a specialization in African American women experiences of their bodies. She's also an Antioch affiliate faculty member. Falami, welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. How are you today?
I am doing well. It is a beautiful day, chilly day here in Atlanta, Georgia, but it is a good day to be alive.
I lived in Atlanta like a while back for like about a year, and like, and I always said, you know, yeah, I don't know what cold is about. You don't know what cold is about.
Right.
But, you know. But I see, that's, you know, true. You're a Midwest girl. You're originally from Youngstown, Ohio.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm a proud.
So, I mean, one of the things that I noticed about you, too, not only are you from Ohio, you chose to go to Antioch University. And
yeah.
I know about Antioch because I was involved with a program that was about community building and youth and social justice. And every year, early on, we would have a group of students come from Antioch who it was part of their curriculum. And I thought, wow, this is just like such a cool school, you know. And they would talk about and how it involved and engaged everything. What made you choose to go to Antioch?
Yes. You know, first of all, the wonderful, rich history in social justice and in social justice activism was my draw to Antioch. I started in Antioch back in the late 90s as I shifted my career and went into education, because before education, I was actually in radio. And I then made a shift from radio into education, teacher education, and did some research in the area. I was living in Dayton at the time. And, you know, of course, there's University of Dayton there, Wright State University, and then there's Antioch, which is there in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And in doing the research, was just so taken really by the social justice activism, the history, the legacy of, you know, the likes of, we know, Coretta Scott King, you know, Mojuba, and she went to Antioch College, but Antioch University has this also, particularly the teacher ed program had this cohort, this idea of we all move together, and it's about practitionership, and the focus is on you bringing your experience, your knowledge, to the classroom and to your courses. And so I was very attracted by the cohort model. I was attracted by the fact that, quite honestly, did not have to take a GRE. And so you were I was had to do an application, but the application consisted of you sharing writing samples, and that's my strength in writing and sharing your voice and so forth, and really getting to know me as a person other than just a test score. So that, I mean, it was just a myriad of reasons why I chose Antioch, from my teacher education program till now as I'm completing my PhD with Antioch. And so it's been a wonderful journey of just great relationships that I've built with the staff there at Antioch.
As you know, I mean, and that was the thing that impressed me about the students who we had met, that they came up and we were really involved in social justice movement. And that was impressed upon them, you know, and they did everything with us. You know, we planted community gardens, you know, we marched in the community, and here were these young people, and they had been different places. Who in your family was that inspiration that, you know, because often when you hear people say, oh, I want to go into do things around community work, social justice work, your family want to say, you need to go get you a real job, you know. But who in your family was that inspiration?
Thank you. I love that question. The person that was an inspiration for me was my mother. My mother, who just passed last year, Mojiba to my mother, was a higher education administration. She actually was, we moved to Youngstown from Arkansas. I actually was born in Arkansas and moved to Youngstown. And in her being a single mother, she was, you know, very much involved in my life and the life of the students at Youngstown State University. But she was very involved in the community work there and had several different board positions. And so I saw her going to, you know, board meetings from the Red Cross. She was involved with the Red Cross. She was involved with nursing home there. I saw her doing the community work. And, and you know, she impressed upon me at an early age, too, the importance of giving back to the community through volunteerism. And so when I was 14, I remember just as distinctly right now wearing that candy striper uniform and working at the hospital there in Youngstown. And I also worked as a volunteer at the Arms Museum, which is a historical museum in Youngstown. And so she taught me through watching her in her community work and in her community engagement how important it is of service and giving back to your community. And then, of course, giving back also was done through church and the involvement in church, you know, through mission work and outreach, and through even just joining, you know, having me to join organizations like Girl Scouts. So that in itself. So I was really steeped in this whole idea of giving back and continuing to give back, and even through, you know, just giving blood is another act of service, right? And so it was my mother. My mother was my inspiration and still is my inspiration as I've, you know, matriculated through this program. And, you know, again, like I said, she passed last year. And one of the things she said was to, you know, get finished with this degree. And, you know, I'm looking at being finished here in the next 6 months. So she is my inspiration.
The power of women, which seems to have, like, stayed with you, and to have that, here's your mother, she's a single mother, she raised you, but she also not only said about just getting by, getting over, but giving back.
Yeah.
And how important that is. So, how far away is Yellow Springs from Youngstown?
Well, Yellow Springs and Youngstown, so Youngstown is northeast Ohio, and Yellow Springs is outside of Dayton. My mom moved from Youngstown when I went to school in Hampton, and she then secured the position as vice president for student services at Sinclair Community College, and she was the first African-American woman to have that position. And so she then moved to Dayton. And so that's how I got to that Dayton area after living in Youngstown and then being familiar with the university systems there in the Dayton area. So, mm-hmm. but Yellow Springs is about 4 hours from, maybe a little bit more, 4.5 hours from Youngstown.
When you were there, and even coming up and watching your mother, what did you think that you wanted to do with your life? Did you want to go into education, or you know, was it just sort of much pretty? Forming, you know, about seeing all these different things, the different parts of your life.
I had no intention in going into education. So, as a little girl, I'm an only child and loved music and was brought up again in the church and participated in oratorical contests and speeches, you know, during the Christmas program, the Easter program. And one of the things that I was always told is that I could speak very well. And I was always doing speeches. And so, and I was writing. So I was writing the family newsletter and creating these mm-hmm. radio shows, you know, back in the day where you would have to put the tape recorder against the radio and click it and mm-hmm. record yourself and so forth. So I had this fascination, and I love news. And so I really wanted to go into radio or television as a result of that. And so I actually went to Hampton and pursued a degree in mass media arts and actually had a radio job during mm-hmm. school while I was at Hampton and when I got out. And so I never had this idea of going into education. What I knew, I mean, my father was an educator, my mother, my aunt, and my uncle. So education is in the blood, but never even considered that. And up until after I, you know, had I went into radio, and at the time I was a single mother, and you know, I was working 6 days a week in radio, and not making a lot of money, and I had this young child, and it was like, huh, maybe I should consider, and this was under the guise of my mother's suggestion, consider education where I can have the holidays and the summers and things like that off to raise my daughter, you know. And knowing that I had a knack with young people because I had taught vacation Bible school, Sunday school, and so forth, that it just came naturally. And so that's how I got into education, but it was not anywhere on my radar as I had hoped to actually land a job at BET in the early stages when I was looking into mm-hmm. television. And so that is how I got into education.
Do you ever find that you're able to incorporate, when you started to get into teaching, did you incorporate some of those skills that you had as far as the being able to express yourself, wanting to be in front of the camera with young people? And how did that, how do you think that impacted them?
I always did some kind of activities. I was a English speech journalism, speech communication teacher. And what I always stressed in all of the classes, how important it is to be an effective verbal and written communicator. And with that, I had them doing exercises where they had to understand how to enunciate and how to articulate. And it's so funny that I met one of my former students who is an amazing young man who's doing wonderful work in the reproductive justice field. And I met him last month in California, and we laughed, and he was sharing how much that I was, you know, I was one of his favorite teachers. And because I talked about how important it is, he said, if it wouldn't have been for you talking to me about how to speak properly and to write properly, I wouldn't be able to be doing what I do now. As he is, you know, on MSNBC as a guest, you know, sometimes, and he talked about that, and that made me feel really good, because especially when I'm working with, you know, young people of color, you know, black mm-hmm. and brown students, and understanding how we have to position ourselves and have they have to position themselves to go anywhere. And with anywhere, that means you should be able to speak in a way that your thoughts are clear, that it's understood and so forth. And so I would have them doing many newscasts as activities. I would have them do impromptu speeches, and he talked about his impromptu speech. He actually remembered it, impromptu speeches, and so that you're able to be that effective communicator. And then, talking about words that should not be used, because he talked about, I would call, we don't use the she be weebies. I be doing this, we be doing this, mm-hmm. and just so that you can be that effective communicator. So I did incorporate a lot. I started a newspaper. I was a yearbook advisor. So those skills that I learned within my radio and television background, I incorporated those activities into the classroom with my students.
Now, it's funny, because sometimes, I went through that, and the ability to be not only to be able to speak up and to do that, and especially now. But does it sometimes when you notice how within everyday conversation, things like, we'd say, like if we were in the hood or with our friends, that now mm-hmm. are becoming part of mainstream conversation, even to the point where you find other cultures co-opting them, and they're mm-hmm. saying things. And sometimes you go and you sort of look at them like, "What?"
Right?
It's like, "No, you're not down with me like that."
Right? Right.
But sometimes and I look at some of my friends, and I'm going like, "No, you didn't say that." How with young people? How do you ever worry that they'll get so much into this? Cool talk, get away
yes.
from the things that you have to learn, that ability to come in and speak clearly, because we know, mm-hmm. particularly in social justice, particularly
yes.
being women of color, when you get mm-hmm. in there, that sometimes using that, people will put you in a box
mm-hmm.
and not hear
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Not hear you,
absolutely.
Even though they're trying to use the same language because they're so cool. But it's still a way of talking, putting us in a box. Do you find
right.
that? Do you sometimes sort of cringe and sort of like, what point do you want to make to young people if they go like, oh, we don't want to talk like that? Or as they say, you talk white. I don't want to talk
white.
Like that anymore.
Right. mm-hmm. Right, right. And and I do cringe. And I understand that there is you being able to, meaning the young people, the young person, being able to articulate in all audiences, and this is what I just say is so very important, and it's not giving up who you are. It's not giving up who you are. It's just understanding that people who are on the outside, you're trying to get a message across. And unfortunately, some people don't understand it unless it's put in a way that they can understand and presented in a way that they understand. It does not negate or does not minimize your blackness. It is just a way to say, okay, this is what I have to do in order to make sure that I'm getting, my message is getting received. Because it does not take away who you are. I am black, brown, African-American, whatever you want to say, 365 all day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, I know that in order there, we live in a society that judges, that looks at us, and it holds us to different standards. And so, in order to get what do you want to happen? What's the message? If you want to make it clear, if you want to make it plain, if you want it to be understood, it is important that you just be mindful of the way in which you are articulating that message and sending that message. But I do cringe. I really do. I do.
mm-hmm.
And And so it was really gratifying to me when I talked to my former student, and he just thanked me and talked about how much it had made a difference. And this young man is doing, like I said, wonderful work. He's, you know, just amazing, amazing. Mm-hmm. And the coming from him, that means a lot, you know. And so, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it is. I mean, and every now and then I'll talk to someone and they get it. And they say, you know, like I was talking to a young fellow who, you know, he said he learned at an early age how to code switch. And depending on where he was, you know, and he said that that's something that he hoped that many of his peers would understand, that, you know, sometimes you switch it up. And he also keeps it on top of his game. And I thought that was just like, I really enjoyed talking to him and going like, okay, I gotcha. Okay. No.
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. Understanding code switching.
Mm-hmm. You know, really.
Yes.
Our next conversation.
That's right. That's right. We can go.
Yeah. Hey, that's, you know what? Maybe down there in Atlanta next year, we'll have a whole thing on code switching, you know.
Oh, yeah. We could do that. Oh, we could do that for sure. I am so down for that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take our first break here. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more.
All right.
About your journey. Okay, we'll be right
back.
Okay. Me. Okay. Well, we're back here on Collections by Michelle Brown, and I am rejoining my guest, Flami DeVoe. You are just amazing. But I found that it was interesting that I listened to you, and it's like, you know, positive role models. You felt really good about yourself. You wanted to be in that. But you talk about how you had some type of body dissatisfaction since mm-hmm. you were 12. Mm-hmm. And, you know, often when I look at little girls, you know, how important I had that too, you know, that mm-hmm. somehow, you know, by whatever the standards were, something wasn't right with me, you know.
Right.
I was looking at a picture, and I'm sitting there with my sister, and we had nicknames. She was Princess, and I was Midget. Okay.
You know? Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's what it says in our
heart.
You know, it's like,
wow.
Okay. And so I know that it's there, and often we don't talk about it, and our family members may not recognize how they're saying, and it makes us look at mm-hmm. ourselves and have that level of dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, what was your midget moment?
Wow. There are so many midget moments. I quite honestly. So, you know, it was coming to this as a little girl. First of all, moving from the South to the North was a traumatic experience for me. And it was a traumatic experience for me because I was much darker than what the kids in my neighborhood were accustomed to seeing and the kids that in my school were accustomed to seeing. So I was teased about my color, my skin complexion, you know. And it was not from the white people. And it was from the black kids, and that was hard. And then I was not what for me. I looking back on it, I was not a larger bodied child, but I was still, you know, felt that I was large bodied, you know, because mm-hmm. of my family was very much about. And then I write about this in my dissertation. I started wearing a girdle literally at 9 years old. And, you know, this notion of hold your stomach in, you know, of course, put your shoulders back. And then that's a whole another conversation about femininity and this how are we socialized, right? And so so then you know, I you shouldn't eat so much, you know. Don't eat so much. You know, girls, women should not go back for seconds, right? So this whole idea of just minimizing what you eat, right? And so these, you know, I have these fat cheeks, so that, you know, people would like to pinch my cheeks. All these little fat, chubby cheeks. Right. Oh, and then I have this one dimple. Oh, look at that! You know, that dimple in them, you know, fat, chubby cheeks. And so this whole these are comments that I heard. You know. So I guess I'm kind of lost your question, but I'm just kind of giving you this how this whole evolution of this body dissatisfaction, you know. So moving from Arkansas to Ohio and then which I know had a very impact, and this is what I referenced just a little bit in my dissertation, but talking about, you know, the neighborhood that I grew in was a mixed neighborhood, you know, Italian, Jewish, Polish, Irish. Not as a lot of black folks and brown folks, and went to school, Catholic schools, and that made a difference. That made a difference in the way in which I perceive myself, my beauty, my worth, because I'm then looking at girls who are thin, girls who are long hair, blonde, you know, lighter complected, you know, so I did not fit that mold of those girls that were in my school. So just, you know, it was just a challenging time for me, because I did a lot of comparison, you know, and then I would have, you know, at home this notion of don't eat too much, don't overeat, don't want to get fat, you know, and then, and I honestly remember, and this is something that is important to think about when you're thinking about, like, what is your body story come from? Where do you have this, get this perception of your body? You know, I remember my mom, you know, doing the cabbage soup diet. You know, and my mom, and I look back on my picture, my mom was not a large body person, you know, and not for saying that large body people should go on diets or anything of that nature, but I'm just saying that she's not what one might deem the person to go on a diet like that, right? So, so needless to say, you know, I remember this, you know, vaguely remember the cabbage soup diet. You know, my aunt was doing Nutrisystem when it first came out. Was that or Optifast or something, whatever, one of those kinds of diets. So that, you know, when you're seeing this as a little girl and then hearing these messages of, oh, you know, hold your stomach in. Don't, you know, you don't want your stomach to get fat. You know, all of that, all of that plays into dissatisfaction.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's so, I mean, there's so many things that you touched on, you know, that I'm going like, yeah, you know, check, check, check. I understand. Girl, I'll tell you, I've got you. My mother at one point in time threw up her hands and sent me to Chatham School.
Oh, wow, yes.
You know, yes. I mean, because it was just like, you know, so that I could learn how to be more of a girl. And the thing you know, as much as we see and we've come, you recognize that we still have, particularly as black women, have issues about our bodies.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. We do. And that is what I keep referencing my research because clearly it's right here in front of my brain right now. But, you know, when I was doing a lot of the reading and just scouring the literature and finding that there were many scholars that were saying, oh, black women don't have issues with their body. They don't. And I'm like, what? Who are you interviewing? Like, you know, and so then I had to think, like, what kinds of, first of all, what was your measurement of how they view their bodies? Did you really, you know, what kind of, who are these women? What's their background? You know, so I was really just breaking it down because there are, I mean, many of us struggle with our bodies, even though we say, some might say, no, I don't have any problems. Okay, so my question is, why are you dieting? Okay, mm-hmm. Now it could be medical reasons, right? But, and that's a whole other conversation, Michelle. We have about four more conversations we can have because because the medical industry, there is fat bias within the medical industry, mm-hmm. and there mm-hmm. And we can talk about how the medical industry bamboozles folks into believing that this weight health is always necessary. The weight is attributed to their health conditions. Okay, but we can talk about mm-hmm. that later. So mm-hmm. I forgot where I was going because I get excited. But well, just saying, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish.
So just thinking about the ways in which we do struggle with our bodies and how does that look? Does it look, and I'm not necessarily just talking about our shape and size, because our body image as women, as African-American women, women of color, black women, it is made up of our shape, size, our hair, complexion mm-hmm. and texture, and our complexion. And so what about the women that are, who feel the need when they go to a interview? Oh, girl, I have to get my hair right for this interview.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
The
hair right is I need to go get it straightened because normally they're wearing maybe a natural look or something like that. And I just heard this 2 weeks ago. Yeah, I got to get my hair right for this interview. So this whole perception of if I do not to alter my look, then I'm not going to get accepted. You know, so it's a lot. It is a lot. And so I'm challenging this notion of, one, you know, where are these voices that are talking about their lived experiences of their bodies, you know, mm-hmm. at the intersection of race, class, sexual orientation. You know, because that is where this whole talking about intersectionality is big too now. And so mm-hmm. what are our lived experiences of our bodies?
Okay, so then you're doing all the scholarly research, and then Lizzo comes up. And then you go like, ah!
Right. Oh.
Tell you, you know, she did a really great interview on Fresh Air, which really goes mm-hmm. deep into it. So usually, you know, like I think I was in Niagara Falls and I said, okay, well, we're going to have this Lizzo conversation, but first you must listen to this. And then so we can have a conversation about mm-hmm. something more than just the visual part.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
you know, as far as like body positivity and doing that, I mean, it's like, what did that do to your research? Did you go like, wow, yes, or like, wow, let me think about it?
So in terms of, are you asking in terms of how do I approach Lizzo's quote-unquote body positivity within my research? Is that what your question is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or did it impact it at all? Or did you find it as confirmation to some of the things you're saying? Or where you said, okay, now I have to think about this?
Well, what I said was, you know, and again, this is just within the initial, my initial research and my initial writing, is that I said that Lizzo shows black women, gives black women a sense of agency, right? She is mm-hmm. taking this ownership and she is driving home what she wants to show as, I'm fat, I'm okay with it, you all deal with it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is that that sense of agency. And so, and sometimes, as we know in movement, it takes that one person or that two people to start the movement, to start the conversation, to start the thinking differently. And then 10, 15 years from now, it looks totally different, right? Mm-hmm. So with Lizzo, she has, and not just Lizzo, there's Sonya Renee Taylor, who wrote the book My Body is Not an Apology. She comes from a place of this radical self-love and embracing your blackness. And there's other that have come out. And so it's this movement of opening the door and exposing. I'm going to be, again, as this scholar in this work, I'm going to be interested to see and to track how this movement, the sustainability of this, and the impact of these pop culture folks in the next, say, 5 years. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. What will the conversation look like then? But again, she is showing her agency, you know, with her body, and for many, as we know, they are like, yes, this is what I need. So yeah, that's what I'm going to say about that right now.
Well, you know, another person who's written a book who's getting a lot, I mean, she's all over the place, Adrienne Marie Brown, whose book is about pleasure activism.
Pleasure activism. You know, I just started reading that.
I mean, you know, and actually, you know, show how it is. Adrienne was involved with Detroit Summer, which is where I first came in contact with Antioch University. And Adrienne is, like, just phenomenal, and to sort of sit and talk with her, and she talks about, you know, about part of it does have to do with, you know, your body and being in your space and doing it. It's a great book. You're going to love it. You're going to love it.
Yes.
That's another conversation.
Yes. Right. You know, I just started reading it.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's another conversation, you know, that we'll have. You know, one of the other things that you wonder too, like, you know, and we're going to go into health in a minute, but one of the other things that I thought about as I read, and actually I wrote a poem that started out, you know, at first I was one way about it, and then it was like all about being natural, but then it's like people embracing themselves. But then I was reading, and most African-American women who have weaves, the hair comes from Cambodia. And unlike people in other countries, many of these women are selling their hair because they're in poverty. And, I mean, there was like this conversation or this thing, here are women in poverty and women who are often also in poverty who are purchasing the thing from that and to so they can get that job, you know, they can get their hair right. And it's like how we are contributing to this cycle of poverty and not empowering women altogether, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say, you know, like if I don't have a problem, if you're getting, you should be able to say, today I'm going to weave my hair just because I just want to look like Diana Ross, you know. And tomorrow, you know, and not do it. But there's that bigger conversation that somehow or other we don't see us part of a female diaspora and what we're doing and how maybe we're keeping one another down and how do we do something to lift each other up and not, it's still the oppressor that's saying to us, you know, you got to get your hair right for this job. It's the oppressor that's saying that's keeping the women in Cambodia in poverty, you know? So it's like, to get to that point, do you see one day, like, would you like to be able to one day to have that kind of, teach that kind of class?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love that opportunity. And when I started my journey through trying to figure out what my research was going to be about, because ironically, I started thinking, I was in, did some work in food justice and food insecurity. And so when I started the PhD program, I was looking into that and then did some reflection and changed gears. But what I, because I, you know, when I started this research into this body image world, it was the term body positivity, you know, body positivity, body positivity. And, you know, that didn't resonate with me. And it didn't resonate with me because for me, it was very surface. And so when I started thinking about, okay, what is needed? What's missing here? It was liberation. And so I began to talk about and to interject the word, it needs to be body liberation. And so my role as a body liberation coach is to have these deeper liberating conversations that are more, that I believe will be more sustainable in carrying women through this understanding of, okay, why are you doing this? And then not only understanding why, but breaking down, let's talk about the oppressor and talk about the impact of where some of this ideology comes from. And then, okay, now that you understand this, does that make a difference? Does that change things for you? You know, because I understand some people might not be open to change. And so I am open to having workshops, doing workshops with women, having deeper conversations and breaking down these ideologies, not from a place of judgment, no, not from a place of judgment, but a place for allowing us to have space and conversation to just to talk and to challenge our thoughts and our beliefs, to understand, you know, what where we are in terms of this whole notion of women and beauty and femininity and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's conversations that we need to have for this next generation, you know, because, I mean, when you stop and you look at it, you know, I was talking to someone about, you know, this is my only political, we're talking about elections, and we were talking about how women voted, and, you know, I was telling one of my non-black sisters that, you know, they needed to get their tribe together, you know.
Hello.
Because, you know, because, I mean, because the statistic that they were showing, like, you know, the percentage of white women who were supporters of this administration, the percentage of Hispanic women who were, and often it was on one topic, and they were saying things like, well, you know, we've been raised that our husband says, and we don't want to rock the boat. And I'm going, and they said, but we can support you because, you know, black women have always, I said, yeah, we've always had to do it. And you need to get your tribe together because is this what you want for your daughters and for your granddaughters to live like that?
Right.
And they were like, you know, and it was sort of like, yeah, I can go and talk to a group, have talked to large groups of non-black women. But those one-on-one conversations that women need to have with women, particularly women of their same socioeconomic and racial class, are so important to changing this if we don't want to continue to perpetuate where we're at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I so agree. I so
you know,
agree.
It's like, you know, it's like, I'm fine. Get your tribe together.
get it together.
You know, really.
Right.
So, which was another thing. I said, yeah, I know you love me and I love you, but this is what I need you to do. You know?
That's right. Let's be okay with that and do that. Thank you.
You know, really, you know, it's okay. You know, Michelle will open the door and then you go in and talk to your people.
Right.
You know,
you're dispatched.
You know, really, you know, I'll be your ally.
right. Absolutely.
Well, we're going to take another break because then I want to really get into health. And
okay.
We'll be right back, okay?
All right.
And we're back here with my guest, Salami DeVoe. You know, I was surprised that you've had two strokes, although I wasn't surprised. I mean, I have a very dear good friend who actually started Lupus Detroit. And in fact, after I had met her, before she was 30, she had had two strokes. So it happens, you know, although we tend to want to think of strokes and all of these things happen later on down the line.
Right.
We also tend to, like you were talking about before, we go to these doctors who will immediately want to say, tell you what weight you're supposed to be about looking at you, you know, about looking at you, or, you know, who provide a lot of pills and medication. And often we take them because we do. The doctor said, I had an aunt who I took care of who was 94, and at one point I took her to a new doctor and said, why is she taking all of this stuff? And they backed it all off. You know, and taking control of our health and what we need to be doing for and to looking at things, you know, it's so important because, you know, I often tell people I went to the doctor the other day, and without even knowing me, it was like the prescription pad was out. Well, you know, you should try this. Why?
Oh,
you know,
God.
I said, you know, you're in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, you know, and I know they think I'm the angry black woman, you know. I'm that angry black woman. I said, you know, well, we're going to try this, that, and the other, and I've done some research, but you should research the disease. I don't have the disease, you know. I mean, I've done that. You know, I've had a male doctor tell me, you know, I hear what you're saying, but do you know how long I went to school, you know, to learn this?
Oh, God.
You know, and I'm going like,
God.
Really? You know?
Really?
So that's why when I saw you and you had your table at the Art Exchange there in Atlanta, I was just you know, somebody who's talking about looking at something other than, you know, whatever the doctor says and how to live better and to take care of yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, I can imagine you could go two ways. After you had two strokes, I can imagine you being, like, very afraid and wanting to go and do whatever they say or being bold and taking the step. What took you down this path?
Wow, yeah. So, you know, first of all, I'm not a quote-unquote classic stroke case. So I had a TIA, which is a transient ischemic attack, which is also called a mini stroke. And it happened, I had a headache, I was dizzy, and my right side of my face began to droop. And went to the urgent care, and they said it was Bell's palsy. And at the time, I had a friend who was a nurse, and she said, go to the emergency room. And this is where, you know, this whole you just got to take the lead sometimes. People take the lead, and you just don't know where. It's like, yes, follow. Okay, I'm going to go. So anyway, I had this TIA, and it was because I had a hole in our heart. We're all born with holes in our hearts. Mine just never closed. And a clot traveled from one side of my heart to the other side. And so that is the reason why I had the stroke. So it wasn't like high blood pressure or anything. I was 37 years old, you know, so it wasn't the classic stroke, you know, case. And so then as talking about my health journey, you know, had to go start seeing a cardiologist. And one of the things that, you know, they talk about, because I also had arrhythmia and sinus tachycardia, and, you know, they, of course, want to prescribe medicine and so forth. I had to be on Coumadin, a blood thinner, and I had to take medicine for the rhythm of my heart, you know, to keep that monitor. And it talked about, you know, what do you do for, you know, pleasure, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm at the time I was raising 5 children, married, and, you know, finished my master's. And so it was a lot going on. And they said, well, you need to get a hobby. I said, well, I love to dance. I love to dance. And so I started taking, and I got into scrapbooking. And I started taking Zumba, and I love Zumba. I loved it so much that, of course, I started teaching it. So I became a Zumba instructor. And, you know, and finding my, what we now know, we call it self-care, my self-care regimen. You know, I picked up meditating, and I would literally lock myself in the bathroom, you know, because, again, I had five children, and would go in there and meditate. So I was doing little things, just kind of walking through this, you know, what self-care looks like. And then I started to do more in terms of more holistic things, you know. So I started incorporating acupuncture, and I looked at Reiki. I started doing that. And then I happened to meet this young lady who introduced me. We talked, and she said, you know, you'll be a wonderful life coach or a holistic coach. And I didn't know anything about that, and started doing some research and ended up getting my holistic health certification. And within my holistic health certification, it just opened a doors to just so much different ways, alternative ways of healing the body and healing the self, and understanding the impact that food plays, the impact of what we call secondary foods, which is relationships, your emotions, your jobs, how that impacts your health. So having a deeper understanding of health and well-being, and then looking at complementary therapies like Reiki, like acupuncture, like sound healing and such, that help to support a positive well-being. And so I then somehow was connected to a woman who has a meditation studio, and she offers training, Reiki, and sound healing. So I decided to get my sound healing. So I wanted to add to that, because I opened up my my wellness coaching practice, and I wanted to add to that, and add not only for others but for myself. So I am a sound healer, in addition to being a body liberation coach, and I do sound healing. So I use crystals, I use tuning forks and sound bowls to promote optimal health and well-being and balancing of the chakras. And so that's an abbreviated self-care journey.
Well, you know, and I think that too, that we often don't recognize some of the things that cause us physical trauma or make us unwell. I mean, I talked to a young African-American woman who took a job way out in the suburbs and said that she was the only one, and she recognized, like, she was like the super major minority, you know. She was black. There weren't that many women. The women who were there were related except for her, because she was the only black person. I mean, there were a lot of men. And so after a certain point, she recognized, like, you know what? I need to take time off, because even the silence that she would walk into, which she knew was may or may not have been conversations of her, but there was a silence, and that it affected her, because somewhere she was having, like she was saying, she was having breakouts, you know, she was having all these things happen, and she recognized that these things affect your health and how to look at it. And she went to, I mean, I know she ended up, she had some Reiki sessions. She did meditation and things like that to find that balance. And often people don't recognize, you know, it's more than just our environment is huge, and the things that impact you, particularly as people of color.
Yes, absolutely.
So, When you start talking with women, you know, what has come up that you have recognized that then you're able to help them, that you know that women of color particularly, we don't recognize, that we just sort of keep trying to get in there. You know, they say, oh, we're strong, we're so strong, but that strength is killing us, you know.
Right, and that is where I start from, this place of self-care is not selfish.
And that comes from our beloved Audre Lorde. And talking about how important this notion that many of us who grew up, and it goes back to how we were socialized. We were socialized, many of us were socialized as women to become the optimal wives and mothers. And with that being said, that means you got to stay busy, keep busy, do everything for everybody but yourself. And then hold on a pedestal that I'm so busy that I can't do anything for myself. So it's really deconstructing this knowledge and this notion of we got to continue on in this fashion. And it's not. And so I've led sister circles with women where I have this conversation to pull out your calendar. Where are you on this calendar? Because I'm the calendar woman here. And so what does that look like? You have so-and-so's piano lesson. You have so-and-so's football practice. You have your husband's this, your partner's this. Where are you in this? And sometimes it just takes that, oh. So then I say, okay, now that you see that you're not in that, and even if you're in that, how much time are you allowing? If it's, 30 minutes, I got to go get my nails done or whatever done in 30 minutes because I then have to go rush to pick up somebody else. So, again, planning time. And I have it. I pull out my calendar. Now, even if it is not something that you get to, but every Monday on my calendar, it says craft time. So it is still on there. It's intentional. Mm-hmm. So how are we being intentional about our self-care, right? So that is important in this conversation. Not only is to deconstruct this notion of I'm the strong woman, I'm this, and so forth. Let's back away from that and talk about being strong is also realizing that I need time for rest. I need time to recalibrate. I need time to just be, and that's okay. And so, and then you have to, not have to, but I advise that it's to think, have to train the folks within your circle, right? If you need your 20 minutes after you get off work or whatever that is, begin to have that conversation because that is a part of that self-care. And so there's this a sister here, and many people are familiar with her, who has started this nap ministry. And I can't think of her name right now, but, her notion is, rest is resistance. And she has garnered a lot of attention because, and I want to meet her, I'm putting it out there in the atmosphere now, that we're going to do some work together because this is all for the health and well-being of women. I think she does work also with others, but again, just napping and, taking away the notion. And I'm an A-type, and I grew up, again, you got to stay busy, keep your calendar busy and so forth. But then this is a way in which we challenge the notion of we have to be strong. You got to rest. You got to rest. You got to do self-care. And again, and I want to say this and I'll stop. For me, what I stress about self-care, it's not necessarily going out and purchasing something, i.e. a vacation or a spa package or something like that. What do you do to nourish and nurture your soul and your spirit? And how do you do that on a frequent basis? And so that's where I talk about this self-care. And if it's going to get that massage, wonderful. What else? Could it be just sitting down and coloring? Could it be, for me, could it be just, I'm going to create a card for somebody and send it and give to somebody else, right? So that's a part of self-care, being in the presence of elders, maybe giving, so thinking creatively about self-care because quite honestly, Michelle, self-care has been co-opted, right? Everybody wants to get on the bag and have self-care, right? I want to talk and want to have this conversation about sustainable self-care and what does that look like.
How important is it to have a sister circle?
Oh, wow.
it is very important, particularly with Black women. It is very important because we thrive in community. And thriving community, if it's just to listen and to hear and to, or just listen and hear, right? Well, same thing, listen and to also to share your experiences. Because it might just be one little nugget that someone says maybe in the last 15 minutes of the session, of this sister circle, that takes you to another place. And so last year I ran a winter solstice sister circle, and that lasted from December to March. And it was, I had a woman from Michigan, I had a woman from Ohio, I had a woman from Georgia, I had a woman from California. It was a virtual experience, and I'll be doing this again, where we got together and we talked about self-care. We did self-care. I offered a sound healing session to women. We talked about different, you know, readings that, you know, dealt with self-care. But having that conversation, just taking time to sit with other women, you know, either virtually or in person, is so very important. It's so very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love it. as you read Pleasure Activism, I could see you and Adrienne Marie Brown sitting down and having like just like so much to talk about, you know, because it's just like, you know, because that's one of the things that she talked about too. It's like, you know, and how at some point not having to do all of that, all this, that, and the other, about having that pleasure. And if you didn't have the pleasure, you know, you're so caught up in doing all this, that's why many people end up being burned out, you know, because they lose that.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, I'm hoping you can make that contact, that connect with us. get this going. Look.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Well, yes. I will. Right now, she's doing, you know, she's been working on how she said, I'm going to step away for a minute. And you know what?
Yeah.
And that's sometimes to be able to do that, and that part to recognize it and to give yourself permission, you know, because often mm-hmm. it's like, oh, I just need to ask you one more thing, because sometimes sort of say, you know, no, I'm stepping away. I'll be back. You'll be fine.
Right.
You know? And it doesn't mean that you're abandoning people, but sometimes that you have to do that for you.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And you know what? When you do it for you, you're better for them.
That's right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, we get to a place where we're not having to explain so much. And again, that's teaching people how you operate. You know, I shouldn't have to explain that I'm lying down on this couch for this amount of time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding, you know, when you're talking about family dynamics, making sure that your family understands the importance of resting, rejuvenation, and then doing as well, you know. And so
mm-hmm.
Just having those kinds of conversations with family members so that it's not so much as explaining. And again, I'm taking from a place of where I used to be, you know, where I used mm-hmm. to explain why I'm lying down. Like, okay, I'm going to get up in 30 minutes and, you know, get to going. No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. So I love the name of your business. It's Holistic Alchemy. How did you choose that name? And, you know, when you think of alchemy, I think the first thing, what was it? They were trying to change something to gold or whatever. it's sort of magical, you know, it's special.
Yes.
So how did you come up with that name?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked that, because I had a former name for my business when I first started my coaching practice. And again, when you talk about evolving, when you really realize you evolve into the person that who you are, it just kind of came. I was having a conversation with the lady that I received my sound healing certification from, and we were just talking, brainstorming ideas, and this whole notion of transformation. And
I'm believing in this holistic concept, you know, of nurturing one's mind, body, and spirit. So it was kind of like just like morphed into, and then I'm a wordsmith. I love words. And so, you know, I'm like holistic. And then I'm thinking about transformation and change and what words represent that. Oh, alchemy. Oh, there it is. So it was kind of like this, and then it just made so much sense within this, because it has been quite magical for me in this transformation into this holistic way of life, you know, in terms of looking at alternative modalities such as using sound healing, using acupuncture, working with crystals and talking about. It was magical for me with the transformation because, you know, coming from, quite honestly, and no shade on, you know, those of us who were raised, you know, Baptist conservative, you know, that wasn't in the repertoire of understanding how, you know, healing and well-being went, right? I didn't understand. I didn't know anything about crystals and all of that growing up, not even in college, you know. So it was, like, quite magical for me, you know, that I got to this place of understanding who I am as a healer and understanding my journey to this healer. And it has been quite magical. So, yeah, that's how holistic alchemy came about.
Well, you know, we're coming close to the end of our time here together. I love the idea of a calendar. And you know what? And I'm going to be more intentional about doing it because I'll be good at it at a certain time. I'm going to put this in, and then suddenly life will get going. And I am quick to delete the time I've set aside for Michelle. I think that is something that's a really easy thing of good first step. What other things, you know, other than, you know, and I hope that anyone in the Atlanta area, but anybody can reach out to you and sort of get some tips or help start a sister circle or whatever. But besides that calendar, making that time for yourself, for self-care, what are other things that you would say that if someone, because, you know, first of the year, everybody is trying to come up with, oh, not New Year's resolutions, which usually by the fifth they've quit doing. But things to put in their consciousness as we go into this new year, what are some things that people need to just mull over?
That's a wonderful question. One of the things that I believe is important, going back to who we are as Black women, is having an accountability partner, if you will. Having that sister that you can call and say, look, can we just go together, whatever that is, because sometimes you need that nudge, you need that reminder of who you are and what you're supposed to be doing. Like, you know, girl, did you do what you said you were going to do on the calendar? You know, so having an accountability partner, someone to encourage you and to remind you to take time for self, that's so important. In this process. And that's why these sisters, you know, sister circles are really good, because you can tap into that, to that network, to talk to that sister. But going into the new year, I like to talk about intentions. You know, there's all these vision board workshops. I've done vision boards and I review my vision boards, but intention, you know, starting the year with intentions. And what I like to talk about is, what are the feelings that you want to have next year? Okay? Because when you talk about, it can become quite easy in having the conversation about, this is what I want to get done. This is what I want to have, you know, to see. But let's talk about going into 22. What do you want to feel? I want to feel joy. I want to feel peace. And then as you focus on those feelings, those activities, or whatever that is, to get to that feeling will manifest. Does that make sense? So I want to talk this year about what are the feelings I want to have. And I'm going to make sure that I, you know, I want to feel nourished next year or nurtured. So what does that look like? And so that's something that I want to put out there, and talking about those and being very intentional about what it is that you want. So vision boards are great. I then challenge, how often are you looking at the vision board? Where is the vision board? You know, if the vision board is somewhere that you don't look every day, and not just look, meditate and reflect. You know, meditate and reflect. So those are the things that I recommend, in addition to setting a calendar, having an accountability partner, making sure that you have some intentions, giving yourself grace. Giving yourself grace. And this is something that some of us might have challenges with. You know, give yourself grace going into this next year. Kindness and compassion towards self going to next year. that's not even what you asked, but it's just something I needed to share.
No, but that's perfect. I mean, you know,
yeah,
that's something that we often don't do. You see, people are so kind and compassionate to everyone else.
Yeah.
And don't cut themselves a minute slack. You know?
No, absolutely not. I should have. Stop shooting. Right? Stop shooting. Right? And just be. And just exist where you are. Exist where you are and where you're trying to go. And then reminding yourself of the feelings that you want to attain next year. And how do you get those feelings? Like, you know, if it's joy, if something is not serving that joy, you don't need it. You know, you don't need it. So when you're thinking about what you need to do in terms of self-care, keep that in mind. Is this serving me, right, in the best way for me to be my best self?
Yeah. There's so many things that we started talking about that there just wasn't enough time that, you know, we're going to talk more about.
Yeah.
We might have a sister circle of talk.
Right. Absolutely. This, I would love this. I mean, again, we could go on, and I would love that. And look forward to seeing you when you come here to Atlanta.
Okay. What is the best way, if someone wanted to learn more about your business and you, what's the best way to find you?
So I am on Facebook and Instagram, Holistic Alchemy, and that's A-L-C-H-E-M-Y, Holistic Alchemy 8. And I also have a website, holisticalchemy8.com. And I am, again, available for women's talks, retreats, sister circles, and conversations. And most definitely, those are ways in which you can connect with me. As well, so through my social media. Thank you.
We will stay connected. Okay?
Okay, all right. Take care, and blessings
all right.
to you.
I want to thank my guest, wife, Alami DeVoe. She's a holistic health practitioner and founder of Holistic Alchemy in Atlanta, Georgia. A body liberation and self-care coach specializing in the self-care of women of color, her work with clients involves individual sessions and group conversations, incorporating her years of research in body positivity. Be sure and follow Collections by Michelle Brown Blog Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let us know if you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future show. You can listen to this or past episodes of the show on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or Blog Talk Radio. Join us next week when I'll introduce you to another amazing individual living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change. Right here on Collections by Michelle Brown. Thank you for listening.